You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line.
Each one of the exhibitions also followed by a text on the side explaining what people see. So sometimes trigger people to tear down the posters.
With the rise of alternative media and the extensive use of the internet to get information out concerning the daily human rights abuses of Palestinians at the hands of the IOF and radical settlers, a group of documentary photographers acting for social change are convinced in the power of photography as a vehicle of change through awareness. We'll speak to a member of the anarchist collective, Active Stills, about their mission to educate the Israeli public about the horrors of Zionist apartheid. Also this week.
And what is happening in Elim, specifically in the last almost 3 months now, is daily acts of civil disobedience and grassroots resistance. People gather in the village almost every day, as many as four times a week, and march towards the construction site of the wall, and just try and stop the bulldozers with nothing but their bodies.
A 27-year-old man is seen on tape being shot by an IOF soldier in the village of Nilin this past week. But that's not the story. The real story concerns the village of Nilin and its ongoing nonviolent resistance to the wall and settlement expansion. Crossing the Line's good friend, Jonathan Pollock, will join us to explain. All that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
This week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for July 19th through July 25th, 2008. Top Palestinian negotiator Ahmad Kure is set to head to Washington for talks over the ongoing Palestinian-Israeli negotiations. As the Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its sixth week, the Israeli army kills one Palestinian and shoots another in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. We begin our weekly report with recent nonviolent actions in the West Bank. IMEMC's Rula Shahwan has the details.
Nearly 200 Palestinians from the village of Al-Khadr, located near the West Bank city of Bethlehem, were joined by international peace activists for the weekly prayer service and marched to protest the illegal wall Israel is building around the village. The protesters held Friday prayers at a nearby military checkpoint, then departed after speeches were delivered. Near Ramallah, as Friday prayers finished, the people of Nilin marched in their weekly protest against the apartheid wall and settlements. They were joined by international and Israeli activists. The protesters walked towards an incomplete section of the wall. As the protesters passed the wall, Israeli soldiers started firing CS gas canisters, concussion grenades, and rubber bullets, resulting in the injury of an Israeli photographer. Early on Wednesday, hundreds of Palestinian children gathered near the border wall between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, carrying plastic saws and hammers, and symbolically attempted to demolish the wall in a move that shows the rejection of the siege imposed on Gaza. Also on Friday, near Ramallah, scores of international and Israeli peace activists, along with villagers, marched against the illegal wall being built on Bilayn. Protesters walked from the village entrance after the conclusion of weekly Friday prayer. The protesters were demonstrating against the Israeli killings of local civilians as well as the illegal closures and confiscation of lands and property. The protesters walked towards the wall in an attempt to get to the villagers' lands behind it. Israeli troops shot CS gas canisters, rubber-coated bullet steels, and concussion grenades at the protesters, causing numerous civilians to suffer from gas inhalation. Additionally, an Israeli reporter was shot by the Israeli troops. For IMEMC.org, this is Rula Shahwan.
Top Palestinian negotiator Ahmad Kure is set to head to Washington for talks over the ongoing Palestinian-Israeli negotiations. Kure's visit is concurrent with a similar move by his Israeli counterpart, Foreign Minister Zibi Levni. This and more by IMEMC's Kendra Puryear.
The two parties' visits come amidst Washington's recent attempts to host a new round of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. These talks continue to be overshadowed by large-scale concerns over the continued Israeli settlement building in occupied East Jerusalem. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon voiced concern on Thursday over Israel's intention to build 40 housing units in a Jerusalem-based Israeli settlement. Earlier this week, Egypt branded Israel's settlement activities a threat to peace. In the meantime, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli President Shimon Peres met this week in the latter's residence in Jerusalem. The two leaders, who laid the foundation for Palestinian-Israeli peace accords of 1993, emphasized the need for reaching a solution to the conflict, yet Peres pointed out that the main obstacle lies in Jerusalem. Also this week, President Abbas met in Ramallah with the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown during his recent visit to Palestine and Israel. Brown pledged economic development in the Palestinian territories. In other news, Israel accused the ruling Hamas party in Gaza of blocking a prisoner swap deal which would see the release of a captured Israeli soldier in exchange for freedom of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. Hamas's Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh hinted earlier in the week that the party is about to conclude an honorable prisoner swap deal similar to that the Lebanese Hezbollah party has recently concluded with Israel through the German mediation. Hamas reiterated to Egyptian mediators that the Shalit case is a separate issue and that any discussion should be separate from the current ceasefire deal with Hamas and Israel. In the meantime, talks over Palestinian national unity are still stalled as both Fatah and Hamas parties insist on preconditions for dialogue. A meeting of representatives from other Gaza factions confirmed on Thursday that unity between Hamas and Fatah is the best means to protect the Palestinian national interest. For IMEMC.org, this is Kendra Purrier.
As the Palestinian ceasefire with Israel enters its sixth week, the Israeli army kills one Palestinian and shoots another. This and more from IMEMC's Rami Al-Mughari in Gaza.
The Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, announced on Tuesday that one of their fighters was killed and two others were wounded by the Israeli army fire in eastern Gaza City. In a statement faxed to media outlets, the brigade said that the three injured fighters had been taking part in a resistance mission when a blast occurred at a Qassam post in the Shijaya neighborhood east of Gaza City. Dr. Muawiyah Hassanein, chief of the emergency department at Gaza's health ministry, told media outlets that one man arrived dead at the hospital, while the other two wounded people, including a child, underwent life-saving surgeries. Earlier on Wednesday at midday, the Israeli army shot a Palestinian from nearby Israeli military zone located on the northern border of the Gaza Strip. Medical sources reported that the Israeli troops opened fire on Abed Hamdan, 25, injuring his foot. He was transferred to a local hospital for treatment. The Israeli army gunfire today came following an Israeli decision 2 weeks ago to shoot at any moving object within 300 meters of the border fence. This attack is the sixth of its kind since the Egypt brokered a ceasefire between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel on 19 June 2008 took effect. The Israeli army continues its two-year-old policy of keeping all border crossings to the Gaza Strip closed. The Israeli forces' siege of Gaza, which has been tightened since June 2007, has had a disastrous impact on the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip and has violated the human, economic, and social rights of the Palestinian civilian population. Approximately 1.5 million people are being deprived of their rights, particularly as it pertains to living conditions, health, and education.
For IMEMC.org, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli army conducted at least 32 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank. The army kidnapped 80 Palestinian civilians, including a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council. IMEMC's William Bascom has the details.
This week's attacks were focused in the cities of Nablus, Hebron, Bethlehem, and Ramallah. This week, the number of Palestinian civilians kidnapped by the Israeli army in the West Bank since the beginning of the year now stands at 1,628. In Nablus alone, Israeli forces abducted 74 Palestinian civilians. Also this week, and for the third consecutive week, the Israeli army continues their campaign targeting Palestinian civil institutions. During the reporting period, Israeli forces ransacked and searched a charity and a kindergarten in Jericho. They confiscated computers and documents. On Thursday, midday, the Israeli army invaded Fugar village located in the southern part of the city of Bethlehem. The army entered the industrial zone in the village and invaded 45 stone quarries in the area. Locals reported that six Israeli vehicles accompanied by trucks confiscated various equipment with an estimated worth of millions of dollars. Moreover, on Thursday at dawn in the West Bank city of Hebron, the Israeli army shot two civilians during encounters with the Israeli soldiers. Israeli soldiers shot tear gas, gunfire, and sound bombs randomly, causing civilians to panic. Since the Egypt-brokered truce between Palestinian Resistance Group and Israel came into effect in the Gaza Strip on the 19th of June 2008, the Israeli army escalated attacks against Palestinians and their property in the West Bank. This escalation led the Palestinian Prime Minister, Dr. Salam Fayyad, to suspend the security plan being implemented by the Palestinian National Authority in the West Bank. Earlier on Wednesday, Israeli military vehicle ran over a six-year-old boy in Hebron. He was critically injured and taken to a local hospital for treatment. Meanwhile, a group of 20 Israeli settlers attacked a house in Borin village in the southern part of Nablus city and injured the residents. Earlier this week, Borin was also attacked by settlers using homemade shells. On Tuesday afternoon, Israeli sources said that a bulldozer driver hit a number of cars on a busy street in Jerusalem. 16 Israelis were injured in the attack. Israeli police said that a security guard opened fire on the bulldozer driver and killed him. Medical sources reported that one person sustained moderate wounds and others were lightly injured. Earlier in July, a Palestinian resident of Jerusalem in a bulldozer attacked a number of Israeli cars, killing three Israelis. He was not known to be affiliated with any Palestinian militant group. For IMEMC.org, this is William Bascom.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report was brought to you by Nathan Dennison and Hussam Kassis.
I speak for a man who gave for this land, took a bullet in the back for his pain. Spilled his blood in the dirt and the dust, and he's come back to say what he has seen is hard to believe, and it does no good to just pray. All he asked of us to stand and we must in this war today. With his mind he sends.
We're saying no more without lives, we're saying.
In Berkeley, I'm Naji Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. If a picture is worth a thousand words, then the images that have documented the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands could fill endless encyclopedias. Ongoing settlement expansion, the apartheid wall, home demolitions, arrests, assassinations, protest marches, and everyday life have been captured on film by independent photographers to show life through a Palestinian lens that the mainstream press refuses to show. Devoted visual media activists have been determined to expose life in occupied Palestine to the world through a different prism, to shed light on a rarely seen horror. But what about the Israeli public? How can they be reached to see the dangers of the Israeli government's policy towards Palestinians? The group Active Stills are a collection of documentary photographers acting for social change, convinced in the power of photography as a vehicle of change through awareness. They seek to bring awareness to issues and situations that they believe create social injustice through images that question the society in which they live in. We are joined now on the phone by one of its members, Shaja, who is based in Jerusalem. Shaja, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Thank you.
Shaja, talk about how Active Stills came about. What prompted you all to come together?
Well, I wasn't the beginning, but I pretty much know the story. There was a bunch of activists from pretty much anarchists against the wall who joined a demonstration against the construction of the wall in Bilin, in the village of Bilin, in the Ramallah region. And after a few demos, they find a common ground for what they believe and how they try to find an alternative for the main media, mainstream media, where the stories either been in the wrong aspect or nobody hear about it. So they decided to start a group, which is a collective of independent professional photographers that will try to get some of the things that we see every week in our work outside in different ways, either into the media or into public space exhibitions.
Shaja,
this was around 2005.
Shaja, as I mentioned in my introduction, the Israeli public in general has no idea how Palestinians live or what sort of things they endure each day from the army. Can you talk about how the group presents the images you have of life in occupied Palestine?
We have around some kind of three ways we try to get them. One, we're doing street exhibitions. That means that we don't want to get to publics and galleries. We hang up posters that are being sorted as an issue in the streets of the big cities in Israel and introducing them to the Israeli public, forcing them to confront with what's happening in the West Bank or other issues we deal with. One was about Bilin, another one was about house demolition. We had a big exhibition about 40 years of the Israeli occupation. The second way is that we're giving some of our pictures to the big websites in Israel, the popular website, which is Ynet News and Walla, which are the biggest news website. And we don't charge money for it because we think it's important enough to give the pictures as long as they only use them on the website. And the third way, we're creating a big archive that is it's accessible to people from around the world, either commercial media or NGOs or even private people that are interested to get some of these pictures. And we distribute it in different ways. If people want CDs with the pictures, we give it to them. If people want for commercial use, we charge it for money. But pretty much open for the public.
And what's been the response from Israelis when you have put these posters up, when you have actually had these open-air exhibitions with the posters and these sorts of things? What kind of response have you all had from the public?
We had different response. Like, some of the exhibition stayed for several months. Some of them stayed for several hours. It really depends on the issue and the photographs that we hang on. Each one of the exhibitions also followed by a text on the side explaining what people see. So sometimes it triggers people to tear down the poster. Sometimes actually we had for us it was interesting because almost like an internet comment. They wrote down what they think or on the pictures, and then people respond to what was written on. So it's like somebody said, this is a lie, it's a left-wing scam. And then somebody writes them, you don't know what you're talking about, it's the truth. But we don't interfere in whatever people do. We believe that we prefer people that react, at least they confront what they're seeing in a way, than not seeing it at all. You know, at least they think, start to think. And maybe after a few exhibitions, it will reach some of the public, because the left-wing people today are pretty small in Israel.
And when the group goes to the West Bank, has it been difficult for you all to capture images of soldiers and settlers doing things? What sort of resistance have you encountered when dealing with the military and the settlers in the West Bank?
It depends on the place we go. If we go to places which have more radical settlements, such as South Mount of Hebron, where the soldiers and the settlers are very violent, and for them a camera is almost a weapon. They try to break the camera. They took people's cameras and asked us to raise the pictures. In Bilin, there were a few weeks where photographers were targeted by the army. It was very obvious that the army was shooting rubber-coated bullets on them. Some other places, the soldiers know the media and the photographers as something that is part of reality, and they just ignore us. But many places can be very violent. In the easy case, they just push us. In other cases, they try to break the camera. It really depends on where we go. It's also, some of us, all of us are also activists. So some places, for them, they know us as activists and they don't refer us as journalists. And then we have a bit of a clash with them. But it really depends on the place we go.
When you're in the places like, say, Bilayin, and the soldiers are aiming their rifles at the photographers, are they also attacking Israeli photographers? Is it mainly Palestinian or international photographers? What I'm asking is, have Israeli photographers been injured while they have been trying to document what the army and the settlers are doing?
Actually, yesterday, one of our photographers, Karen, while we were walking back after the demo, and the photographers knew us, and they knew her as a photographer because she worked with the camera, they shot tear gas, and a second later, they shot rubber-coated bullet, and she got injured. We had to evict her, to evacuate her to an hospital, and fortunately, she didn't get injured badly, or seriously, and she's just sitting home, and she can't walk. It happened to me around 6 weeks ago. I got also a direct hit. Definitely knowing that we are photographers because we're holding the camera. Two other cases, which were with video cameras, which also people, they knew that there are Israelis over there, they also shot directly. It really depends on the place, as I said before, where you are. I think in Bilin, they know the faces, also in Yalin, and they target us personally. They really don't like Israelis in some of these places, and they try to be more violent toward us. Other, because they know us already personally, they can recognize our faces and that we're coming in Bilin every week, and in Yalin it's every second day. There are 3-4 demos a week, so they actually, we confront the same soldiers. They definitely target Israelis. Last week when we had a big demo, both photographers and Israeli protesters who came. But because we're willing to take a risk also when we're going to the front, we're not at the back, we're not only photographers, we're also demonstrators. Our presence is another tool for the struggle that we're taking part of, the joint struggle with the Palestinians against the occupation. So we're willing to take the risk of being in the front and getting injured. But definitely the case yesterday when they shot Karen was directly to her or to the other guy who was near her with no reason to do it. There was no violence at the moment. It's the end of the demo where we were already walking back. Fortunately, she didn't get seriously injured.
Shaja, what about B'Tselem's new program entitled Shooting Back? They've distributed a number of video cameras to Palestinians in order to document what has happened to them vis-a-vis the settlers. I recall recently that a whole family was attacked while they were filming settlers approaching them on their lands while they were herding their sheep, and they were physically beaten with clubs, anywhere from very young children to old women and men. Are you all encouraged by seeing organizations like B'Tselem and others
now distributing cameras in order to document what's going on in the occupied territories?
Yeah, we are very happy for any kind of access to media that is being from the field or from the people that actually live there, because we come from Israel, we have the privilege to come and go, but also a limit that we're not there all the time. In places like South Mount of Hebron, where they have daily attacks on them in the last few weeks or 2 months, it's very, very important because they can show, first of all, we don't do video, we don't take video, we do still photography. So sometimes we capture a moment, but we can't capture the whole event. So video photography is very, very important anyway. But especially in places like this, this can be an evidence for court and another media, that type of media that we can try to distribute later. Personally, we work with B'Tselem. We know the spokeswoman of B'Tselem very well. She's a very good friend, and we try to work together. We do things that join effort with other organizations. We work well. We had a big exhibition and a project with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, where we document the situation in East Jerusalem, where Palestinians don't get a permit to build a house or extend the house. So the result of house demolitions, and we had a big exhibition about it. Now we're working with two projects with the ACRI, which is an association, it's a human rights Israeli association, and we have one is about one of them is about public housing or the right for housing, and the second one is about humanitarian international law in the West Bank and Israel. We find it very important to work together. This is what one of the reasons we have this big archive. We want these organizations to use it. And when they have their own projects, we really support it. We think it can work together very well. Because we went to one of these places, the place where you mentioned Susia, where they had the attack. And 3 days later, Karen, our photographer, went there with the B'Tselem people and Israeli people, and they've been attacked by the soldiers. They took the same camera recorder, and they erased it. They took the cassette, and they tried to break the camera. And we think it's very important, just because, especially legally, is very much stronger than our evidence, much better. And also, I think any evidence that gets out from the West Bank or the occupied territories, Palestinian territories, is a good evidence.
And finally, where can people go to see the archive photos that you all have of your work?
Well, we have two websites that are on. It's actually the same archive, which is one is www.activespills.org, and the other one is www.flickr.com/activespills. Both will lead to the same archive, but in a different design. And we are working these days for a new design for our website, which will be hopefully online in the end of August or beginning of September, and it will be much more accessible to the public, and there will be a way to sort the collection different ways and easier ways to find pictures than it's designed now. And everybody's welcome to go through the website. If they want to contact us, they just need to email us and ask us, tell us exactly what they need the pictures from, and then we discuss with them if they need to pay or if they just can use it freely in any way we need to know how they use it. And then usually we never limit our pictures unless it's for commercial use. We try to distribute the picture as much as we can. If somebody has a economic problem at the time, we give the pictures usually with not a problem.
And we're going to leave it there. We've been speaking to Shaja, a member of Active Stills, a group of documentary photographers acting for social change, convinced in the power of photography as a vehicle of change through awareness. They seek to bring awareness to issues and situations that they believe create social injustice through images that question the society in which they live in. And you can check out their website at www.activestills.org, and we will link to this site. Shaja, I want to thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line, and please stay safe.
You're most welcome.
In Berkeley, I'm Naji Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. A 27-year-old Palestinian man is shown blindfolded and handcuffed by IOF soldiers in the West Bank village of Nilin. Moments later, the soldier aims his rifle at the man's leg and fires. The Palestinian is shown a split second later on the ground in obvious pain. A 14-year-old girl captured this incident on film and the footage given to the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. Since that time, B'Tselem has called for a full and independent investigation into the shooting. The army, for its part, has stated that it will conduct its own investigation into the matter. The soldier who fired the shot has thus far not been disciplined. At the time of the shooting, the victim, Ashraf Abu Rama, was protesting the ongoing apartheid wall. Nilin, like many other Palestinian towns, has actively resisted the annexation of their lands. But Nilin's form of nonviolent resistance is unique in that the entire village as a whole has risen up to practice daily civil disobedience against the wall, soldiers, and settlers. However, this sort of active nonviolent resistance has gone virtually unnoticed in the mainstream media, while the recent bulldozer attacks in Jerusalem have received constant coverage and in-depth analysis. We look now to Crossing the Line's good friend Jonathan Pollock, a member of the group Anarchist Against the Wall, who, along with international activists and Palestinians, has been involved in nonviolent protests against the illegal confiscation of Nilin land, and who have actively tried to inform the public on what is happening on the ground. Jonathan Pollock, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Hi, thank you. Nice to be back.
Jonathan, can you talk about the work that Anarchists Against the Wall, as well as the internationals and Palestinians, are doing in the village of Nilin?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important to me to stress that everything we do is led by Palestinians, and I mean that basically what we do is joining the Palestinian struggle. That's why we feel that we have a moral obligation to join it. We do not feel we own the struggle. We're not there to show Palestinians how to resist or to tell them what to do. It is the struggle for their liberation, and everything that is being done by them, supported by us. And what is happening in Nilin, specifically in the last almost 3 months now, is daily acts of civil disobedience and grassroots resistance. People gather in the village almost every day, as many as 4 times a week, and march towards the construction site of the wall, and just try and stop the bulldozers with nothing but their bodies. This has been going on, as I said, for almost 3 months now, and have been met by extreme military repression towards something that is obviously a civilian uprising. There have been over 200 people wounded, and we're talking about not about people being batoned or anything like that. We're talking about people being shot with rubber-coated steel bullets, even with live ammunition at times. 4 people have been shot with live ammunition. Collective punishment was imposed on the village in the form of siege and curfew for almost 1 week. That was resisted by the villagers bravely and eventually lifted. This is what's been going on.
Jonathan, are you telling me that for like the past 3 months, the army has basically been firing into crowds of nonviolent peaceful protesters that have included Israelis and Palestinians? So essentially, they're not really even trying to arrest people. They're just literally trying to harm them directly and not even give out any warnings?
There have been arrests, but basically demonstrations are attacked on site. I don't really like the term nonviolent demonstrations, because I think it suggests, I think there's something racist in it, because if we would have a demonstration in Tel Aviv, no one would bother describing it as a nonviolent demonstration. You would just say demonstration. But somehow with Palestinian, you always have to justify protest and stress that it was nonviolent. Also, I feel that the term nonviolence goes against the use of violence, which I think Palestinians have the right to do. Of course, within moral guidelines, I think that assaulting soldiers who shoot at you is definitely something legitimate. And also, indeed, there is some violence from protesters in retaliation to army violence. There is some stone throwing. But I think that the important thing is that it's a popular uprising. It's something done by the people, not organized from above. It does not have any militaristic aspects to it. No vanguard. It's just the people rising up against their oppression, against their oppressors. So that's what's important to us. It's just that it's unarmed and grassroots.
Jonathan, it seems that one of the things that has been happening recently with the 2 bulldozer attacks that recently occurred, we had seen constant coverage here in the West in regards to that. But with the incident of the soldier shooting Ashraf Abu Rahma in the foot, as well as what I understand yesterday, the arrest of the girl who actually filmed Ashraf Abu Rahma being arrested.
Not the girl herself.
Yes, of course. Her father was arrested. This coverage has not been shown in the West. As a matter of fact, to the best of my knowledge, within the mainstream press, not even a shooting, the illegal shooting of an unarmed, handcuffed, blindfolded man was shown. Has there been any coverage within the Israeli press? And what sort of outrage or any kind of discussion has happened with respect to this?
Well, generally, the demonstrations in Yalin are being covered. Within the Israeli press, they are being covered. If you ask me, not as much as they should be. And generally, almost always, from the military's perspective, with maybe a small comment in the end by the demonstrators. The shooting was covered pretty extensively in the Israeli media. But I think that the main point was not made, that a very high-ranking officer was there, was involved in the incident itself. The same officer in charge of all the soldiers who were present in suppressing these demonstrations. And I don't think that this is coincidental. I think that this incident represents the way soldiers, the way this brigade interact with demonstrations, the way they feel towards demonstration, that this is war and that these demonstrations should be suppressed in military means and that everything goes. The army is very successful in conveying that to the Israeli media, that demonstrators are violent, that the demonstrations are violent, that soldiers are being hurt from time to time. And I think this illustrates that the source of violence, that the real violence in this case, is the army, is instigated by the army, and the way it deals with a civilian uprising of the oppressed towards their oppressors.
This past week, Barack Obama visited the Middle East. His last stop within the Middle East was Israel, and he received almost literally a cult-like following, almost like a rock star status. I remember seeing something that he had visited the town of Sderot, in the south of Israel, where Palestinian resistance fighters have fired homemade rockets. However, just a short distance away was Gaza, which has been hermetically sealed off for well over a year. There are fuel shortages. There is sewage running in the streets. There are, at least at the time, what's known as a tahida, which is a tense calm, happening right now. But still, there is daily suffering amongst the Palestinians there. He had constantly said throughout his time there that the United States would be a friend to Israel, that it would always be there for them. But he has yet, as he had said in the past, been fair-handed in regards to his concern for Palestinians. How have people reacted towards his visit that you have talked with in regards to his visit?
Well, I think the Israeli media and Israelis generally are somewhat scared by Barack Obama because of the change discourse that he represents. And a discourse that I think is empty. I'm obviously no expert on U.S. politics, but it's clear to me that U.S. interests are the important thing here. And U.S. interests have not changed. The U.S. needs Israel as a colonial proxy in the Middle East, and that's the important thing. Democrats, Republicans, the differences are cosmetic. As far as it concerns the policy towards Israel.
What about? Yes, go ahead.
I mean, I don't see a big change of policy without either candidate. They will all support Israel, even if one will push Israel, force Israel to some more lip service towards the Palestinians. The general position that Palestinians are the violent side and Israel is just defending itself, I think will remain. And I think that also the process of perpetuating the occupation will continue at force.
Well, moving on, I'm wondering if you could talk about the repression that the
Israeli army has put on specifically those within the protests in Nilim with respect to arresting Israelis, constantly having them go to court and stand trial. The legal aspect of the repression that they are now starting to impose, especially upon Israelis and internationals who are resisting with the Palestinians in Nilim.
Well, I think that the oppression is never specific on Israelis, I think, that or internationals. There have been Israelis, internationals, and Palestinians arrested at these demonstrations, which is a source of mainly monetary, financial problems for us, as legal aid is needed and needs to be paid for. And this is a very effective tool of repression. Palestinian Popular Committee members have been arrested. Israeli activists have been arrested and indicted. And also internationals have been arrested, and one is about to be deported in the coming days.
And have they stepped up to deportations? I know that in recent months they have been actively deporting people. A friend of mine, Harmit Sudan, who was on the show, was deported. A noted academic, Norman Finkelstein, was denied entry. Are they now starting to actively go after even more prominent people to keep them from standing in solidarity with Palestinians in the country?
There was definitely a stepping up of denying entry of prominent figures lately. And now it seems like there's also stepping up of active deportation, of actively deporting people who are already here and arrested in these demonstrations. One of the international demonstrators who were arrested, who was arrested on Thursday, is now facing deportation. And he is the first activist to be deported, not because of visa reasons, or staying permit reason, of overstaying his permit for, I think, a couple of years now.
And finally, Jonathan, for those who want to help out financially with the legal issues that those who are now facing court fees and lawyer fees, where might they be able to go in order to help out?
There's information about everything we do. Well, not everything. We're a bit behind. But there's information about what we do and how to donate in our website, which is awall.org, A-W-A-L-L. .org/donations. That's the donations part, and if you remove the donations, it's just our website with information about what we do.
Our guest today has been Crossing the Line's good friend Jonathan Pollock, a member of Anarchists Against the Wall, a direct action group that was established in 2003 in response to the construction of the wall Israel is building on Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank. And you can check out their website and also give out any help for legal fees at www.awalls/donations.org. Jonathan Pollock, stay safe, and thank you for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you for having me.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist who chronicles the human condition. He has been a resident of Pennsylvania's death row for 25 years. Writing from his solitary confinement cell, his essays have reached a worldwide audience. His books, Live from Death Row, Death Blossoms, All Things Censored, Faith of Our Fathers, and the recently released We Want Freedom, have sold over 150,000 copies and been translated into 9 languages. His 1982 murder trial and subsequent conviction have been the subject of great debate.
Beyond elections. If TV news channels are any measure, the U.S. presidential elections, now less than 4 months away, are the permanent stuff of headlines. If candidate A sneezes, it's breaking news. If candidate B hiccups, it's film at 11. It's hardly worthy of headlines. but the beast must be fed. For far too many people, this news overdose on the elections has bred a kind of passivity among millions as they wait in front of TV screens and computers like deer caught in headlights. What happened to anti-war protests? What happened to housing rights protesters? What happened to anti-FISA activists? People are dulled by the almost sure expectation that Democrats will prevail in the next election due to the low ratings of the Republican Party and President Bush. And those dull expectations are based upon the totally unfounded faith that a Democratic win of the White House really means an end to the war. Millions have forgotten the bitter lesson from the midterm elections when Democrats prevailed in congressional elections, formed a majority in both houses, and proceeded to do nothing. Peace in Iraq? Off the table. Instead, like lemmings leaping off a cliff, they voted for more and more billions for war. And what of FISA, or the expanded Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which legalized the law-breaking of the Bush administration and gave retroactive protection to phone and communications companies, which violated prior law. FISA signed, sealed, and delivered, and even the Democratic candidate who blasted the bill signed it into law. Elections aren't endings, they are beginnings, and movements mustn't stop moving. They should continue to protest more. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer Ghassan Banura, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Najee Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.